Welcome to Talk Eastern Europe, a podcast on Central and Eastern Europe and a sister project to New Eastern Europe, the exclusive bi-monthly magazine dedicated to this region. My name is Adam Reichert, and with me is the second co-host, Maciek Mikulski. Hi, Maciek.
Hello, Adam. Hello, everyone. This podcast develops thanks to the generous support from our patrons, for which we are truly grateful. If you like what we do and want to become our patron, please visit us at www.patreon.com.
And Talk Eastern Europe is also a member of Europod, a network of European podcasts which brings discussions on political and societal trends in Europe and beyond.
On November 15, Maia Sandu won the second round of the presidential elections with 57% of the votes, and she became the first female president in the history of Moldova. In the second round, she defeated the incumbent president Igor Dodon, who in the last year actually seemed to have all the cards in hand to maintain his rule for the years to come. So what happened during the electoral campaign, and what are the prospects for Moldova? These are the two main questions we would like to discuss in this episode of Talk Eastern Europe. And Adam, I would like to start maybe with a short question to you, because I think our listeners already got used to that situation in Moldova changes dramatically very often. And those observers who closely were observing what is going on in Moldova, I think they were not that surprised by the electoral win by Maia Sandu. But nevertheless, I think that, you know, now the situation is very interesting, because at the end of 2019, we were rather in the situation that the pro-European political forces, groupings were rather cornered, and Igor Dodon seemed to be a dominator on the political scene on Moldova. So interesting developments and interesting future ahead for the country.
Very interesting, and I think it just once again the year 2020 shows us that anything can happen, and expect the unexpected. I myself was not fully sure that Maia Sandu would have such a chance. I was surprised that she won, not only won in the second round of the elections, but she won with quite a pretty good margin. Despite also, you know, Igor Dodon had such a strong hold of power. He was consolidating his control in the country after Vlad Plahotniuk left. He was, you know, probably the main oligarch / controller of the country. He fled Moldova in early 2019, and that was when the pro-European forces had a brief chance to be in power in the parliament. Actually, Maia Sandu was the prime minister for a very short period of time, and as you mentioned, Maciek, as you mentioned, that period fell apart towards the end of last year, 2019, and that was when we started to see Igor Dodon consolidate his party power around his party, the Socialist Party, getting more and more support for his initiatives, also from Plahotniuk's previous party. And so Maia Sandu was really the last. Her victory is kind of this reversal, and it's really interesting to see what will happen next in the country of Moldova. So maybe for our listeners out there who probably haven't been following that much about Moldova, of course, we at Talk Eastern Europe are probably one of the only podcasts that cover Moldova such in depth. But I do think it's important for us to understand that this is an important development, not only politically for the country, but also geopolitically for the region.
Yeah, as you said, we were trying to follow here at Talk Eastern Europe the situation in Moldova all the time, and we did some episodes on Moldova last year, so those who are interested in going back to those episodes, or who are not very familiar with the situation and the developments that took place last year in this country, you will find some links in the notes of this episode. And maybe one more thing I would like to add as a kind of a context of the political situation right now within country is that it's huge victory, without doubt, for Maia Sandu and pro-European political forces in Moldova. But nevertheless, we should remember that if we talk about the executive powers in the country, it is Prime Minister who possess the main power. So I think this victory has for sure very, it's powerful because it's also symbolic, and Maia Sandu is now one of the most popular politicians in the country, so she will have some arguments when it comes to next parliamentary elections in the country. So also from that point of view, it is interesting to observe how she will be behaving on the political scene right now.
Yeah, I think it is quite interesting to watch. I also highly recommend checking out to our listeners the previous episodes that we've done. And we will also put some links. We have some recent articles that we published in New Eastern Europe regarding the changes in Moldova and the elections. So I'll recommend that you, if you want to read more about it, there will be those resources as well.
So I think it's a good moment to invite everyone to listen to the interview we did about the elections, about the campaign. Adam, could you maybe introduce our guest speaker?
Sure. We interviewed Gina Lentin, who is a senior program officer at Freedom House, responsible for covering Eastern Europe and Turkey, and she's one of the leading experts on Moldova. We've actually had Gina on the program before, so some of you might recognize Gina and her expertise. And we invited her for this episode to also give some reflections on the elections and the results in Moldova.
Welcome back to the program. We are joined by Gina Lentin, a senior program officer with the Europe and Eurasia program at Freedom House. Hello, Gina. Welcome back. It's great pleasure to have you again at Talk Eastern Europe.
Hi, Maciek and Adam. Great to be back. Thank you for having me.
Gina, last time we spoke with you about Moldova, it was in the end of last year, maybe November, if I remember correctly. And in Moldova conditions, it is the whole political era, I can say. And the phrase that the situation is dynamic, I think, fits perfectly to this country because we had a lot of development since then. And today we want to focus on the presidential elections, the results, but also possible further consequences of these elections. So maybe let's start from a very basic question to you. Did you expect such an outcome of the elections, or it was rather something what surprised you?
So I think that one important thing to note about these elections is that it was, I think, really a triumph of the will of the people and the will of the voters. To be honest, I'm not surprised by the outcome of these elections. I think that, as you know, and I think as we discussed last time, people in Moldova, particularly among civil society, which is the group that I work most closely with, have been really frustrated by the level of entrenched and systemic corruption in government institutions for a very long time. Maia Sandu, when she ran for president in 2016, ran on the promise of finally tackling Moldova's problems with endemic corruption. And of course, this is something that civil society actors and many citizens strongly supported. However, after she did manage last year to become prime minister in the short-lived coalition government with the socialists, she did, we did recognize how challenging it was, to govern, once in office, because even though she did run on this anti-corruption platform, in reality, due to the fact that the socialists were also part of the coalition, and still managed, of course, a big section of the big percentage of the parliament. In reality, this made kind of implementing this vision much more difficult. And of course, due to bitter disagreements over how to reform the justice sector and the media in particular, the coalition, of course, as you know, last year did fall apart. That said, of course, while there was tremendous disappointment around that, I think that civil society actors and also citizens have still been kind of very galvanized and excited about and supportive of Maya Sandu. So again, the fact that the voters turned out for her, particularly in the diaspora, I think it was, you know, really thanks to the diaspora vote that she was able to win in a landslide during the runoffs. You know, it's a sign that, you know, people are really ready for change. You know, I think that, you know, there's a lot to celebrate with Maya Sandu, you know, as an anti-corruption, you know, reformer in the role of the presidency and also to Moldova's first woman president.
If we look at the election and the outcome of the election, what would you say are some of the factors that led to Dodon's defeat and Sandu's victory? Maybe setting aside coronavirus, unless if that was one of the main factors. But I think what's very interesting is that, you know, we were, a lot of people did not really, I mean, you mentioned you expected that Sandu would win. I myself was not personally convinced that Sandu would win. And there was a lot of discussions kind of leading up to the election, at least at the end of, around this time last year or middle of this year, that if Dodon did win, this would be almost the end of the hope for Moldova, that it would certainly go into Russia's orbit. And that, mm-hmm. that didn't happen. So there was some sort of, the emergency brake has been pulled. But so why did Moldovans go for Sandu over Dodon, who clearly had a lot to his advantage, including a lot of control over media and the messaging?
You know, it's funny, it's funny kind of thinking about that because, of course, you know, in the back of my head, you know, we had our own elections here in the United States and, you know, there were a lot of questions as to, who will win because, of course, you know, there was a likely outcome that, you know, President Trump could win a second term. So perhaps that kind of, in some ways, you know, that was...
But Dodon right. conceded.
Exactly. This is a big difference. Oh, gosh.
Yeah, yeah.
We could have a whole different session about American politics. So I think, you know, kind of, again, as is the case with, you know, kind of as is the case with Moldova, of course, it's, it was more... If we were looking at different scenarios, it would appear more likely that Dodon would have, you know, won another term of the presidency, which would give him, you know, a chance to kind of realize his own agenda, which you presented in your question. However, of course, you know, there is always the chance that the opposition candidate could win. And of course, a big factor, and it is worth mentioning that, you know, while Moldova's elections, you know, typically do kind of face some of the same challenges, you know, the OSCE and NMO both did kind of independent election observation missions there. Some of the challenges that kind of continue to dog Moldova's elections process include, of course, a highly polarized media environment. You pointed to the fact that, you know, President Dodon controls a significant percentage, almost 75% of the media holdings in Moldova. Of course, like one of the big ones includes television, which many people use as their main source of information still.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, polarized media environment and, you know, biased coverage continues to be a challenge. Of course, another challenge that is pointed to time and again is the use of kind of disinformation and inauthentic behavior online, particular domestic disinformation and, you know, very kind of unbalanced, unbalanced rhetoric that almost kind of borders on, in some cases, hate speech. In the kind of online realm, and of course, many Moldovans do use Facebook as, you know, as a source of not only kind of communication and social networking, but also of news and information. And then, of course, you know, there's the challenge that's kind of brought up time and time again of the question of busing voters from Transnistria to Moldova. Of course, some people do have two passports, but it's been, you know, kind of highlighted and mentioned as something that contributes to irregularities in voting. However, it's important to mention that in both of these assessments, you know, Moldova had, you know, a free and fair election that would really had very minor irregularities. And this is huge because, of course, you know, over the years, we have seen improvement, significant improvement in Moldova's election process. So I think, too, given this information, you know, this also gave me hope that, you know, perhaps a Maia Sandu victory could be an outcome. But I think really the thing that pushed her over the top was the voter turnout, particularly in the diaspora. When the first round of elections took place, and there was, you know, a difference of a percentage point, or maybe half of a percentage point between Dodon and Sandu, the first reaction I had is, if she wants to win, she really needs to turn out the vote. And, you know, that appears to have happened for her, again, particularly in the diaspora. And that was really the thing that put her over the top. I think that, you know, if the diaspora voters had not turned out in droves for her, that, you know, I think that then we really would have seen a Dodon victory. It is worth mentioning, because you, Adam, you rightfully mentioned the coronavirus pandemic. Mm-hmm. Dodon has, with the exception of, you know, an emergency, emergency orders that were put in place back in March, President Dodon has done very little to address the pandemic, because Moldova continues to have an increasing caseload. It's, you know, it's significant, you know, given the size of the population. There are currently around 91,000 cases of coronavirus in Moldova. And this is significant for a country that has, you know, fewer than 3 million people.
Yeah.
Like, essentially, if you were to look at the curve, it's just been kind of exponential growth with no kind of plateau. So back in March, of course, Dodon did institute some emergency measures. But one of the challenges was that those emergency measures did kind of unduly restrict key human rights and fundamental freedoms. I would say one thing to highlight was especially for journalists, because during these kind of times of crisis, and certainly in the middle of pandemic, a free press is incredibly important to informing the public about what's going on. So often, you know, around that time, the government was giving kind of conflicting information about the coronavirus, about, you know, what to do and how to protect yourself. And they also, too, for, you know, press conferences with government officials that should normally be, you know, that normally kind of a range of journalists should have access to, they were kind of allowing selective access for specific media outlets that were more sympathetic towards the socialists and not necessarily kind of letting everyone in there, which of course, you know, resulted in, you know, in kind of like, ultimately unclear directives from the government, kind of conflicting information as well. And, you know, during these times, it's critical that the press, you know, let the public know.
And not to mention the messages coming out of the church as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it's funny because I feel like this is a trend, speak with the church, at least, this is a trend that we see kind of in other countries in the region where religion still has a strong influence over politics. politics, of course, mm-hmm. you know, you can't help but think of Poland. But the, but of course the Orthodox Church, you know, is closely intertwined still, probably overly intertwined with Moldovan politics. And of course, like out of the church, there's been tremendous just denial of the coronavirus and that, you know, if you, there's great reporting coverage of, you know, the, I think an Orthodox, I think it was a Orthodox leaders organized a, it wasn't called a pilgrimage, but they, walked around the entire kind of border of Moldova, and, you know, prayed and, believed that this would make the coronavirus go away. So, you know, I would say on Dodon's side, there's been, you know, there certainly has not been sufficient effort to deal with the pandemic, and, you know, in a way that both kind of respected that, you know, kind of respected respected fundamental rights and freedoms, but that also too, you know, contain the coronavirus as it, you know, as it needed to kind of be addressed.
Mm. Since you already mentioned the role of diaspora, I would like to talk a little bit more about this topic because, as you said, people who live abroad were very mobilized to take part in this election. But there is a diaspora in the West, in the Western Europe, in the United States as well. But also there is a diaspora, Moldovan diaspora in Russia. So I wanted to ask you if people who lived there were also such mobilized or there, because I think there was a difference in mobilization between diaspora in Russia and in the West. And if yes, why we have seen such differences? And maybe also a sub question to it is, because the majority of people from diaspora voted for Maya Sandu, so the question is if Dodon did anything to attract those voters during the campaign.
You know, that's a really good question. Yes, there was a big difference between diaspora turnout in Russia versus in the EU and the United States. It seemed that Dodon focused more closely on voters in Moldova. And, you know, and that was kind of the population that the socialists sought to turn out. Whereas, in contrast, the voters that really turned out for Maya Sandu were those in the diaspora. It is worth mentioning, actually, because I highlighted the kind of election observation, missions and, mission reports. It was challenging, for voters in the diaspora to cast their vote. It is, you know, typical that they have to navigate, you know, long lines, very kind of a disorganized process. You know, you probably saw there were photos, in, you know, coming from Germany, coming from Italy.
Not enough ballots, right?
Yes, exactly. Where people were waiting in line for, you know, 4 or 5 hours. And of course, there were some reactions from civil society and then also from kind of folks and analysts in the international community who said, well, you know, is this a form of voter suppression? Which is, of course, you know, I think a very important question to consider, because it was, at least from accounts from folks I've talked to, it was easier to vote in Moldova than it was to vote, you know, in the diaspora. But I think that there was a very big difference between, you know, voters who turned out for Dodon in Moldova versus those, you know, in the diaspora who didn't seem to turn out as strongly for him.
And what about, you mentioned Transnistria of previous elections of being bussed in. How did it look this time? Were voters in Transnistria allowed to vote? And I would imagine they would have been overwhelmingly for Dodon. So how did they try to encourage or bring voters from Transnistria over?
Yes. So there were voters that, you know, that came from that were brought from Transnistria. It is worth mentioning too the fact that some, you know, some people in Transnistria have two passports. So they have, you know, a Moldovan passport, which then, of course, does allow them to vote legally in Moldova.
Yeah.
The OSCE report this time around said that the election administration did manage the technical aspects of the election efficiently and transparently. And, you know, polling stations for voters residing in Transnistria were set up properly. And, you know, on kind of, you know, kind of as far as that issue goes of kind of bringing in voters from Transnistria, there were not as many kind of irregularities or funny business this time during these elections.
Interesting.
Which is, I think, very important to note because, as you know, and as we were discussing, this has been a big problem in the past. You know, it's something that, you know, it's something that does come up kind of time and time again as an irregularity.
Mm.
But, you know, but of course...
Was it because Dodon was overconfident this time around, or was there just a lot of pressure to have a much more open and fair election?
That is a good question. I mean, I think, you know, if you were to ask my personal opinion, I guess, you know, and perhaps this is, you know, you know, the kind of like my optimistic side coming through, I would say that... You know, again, I think that, you know, I think that Moldova certainly faces its challenges when it comes to, you know, when it comes to corruption in institutions and in processes. But I would say that, you know, kind of over the, you know, over the years, there has been, you know, there really has been improvement kind of in the electoral process and in the transparency of the process and in efforts to kind of mitigate irregularities and fraud. So I would say that perhaps, maybe optimistically, it's a testament, you know, to the institution, the electoral institution, and the, you know, improvement that we've seen. That we've seen over the years. And again, we do have documentation of it through reports of impartial observers, such as, you know, OSCE, ODIHR, and NMO. So maybe, again, I might be, that might be my optimism coming through, because of course, like, there are still, you know, major challenges around the elections. I, you know, certainly wouldn't deny that. But I think that, you know, we are seeing, you know, we're seeing just, better managed, more transparent elections, you know, in Moldova. But of course, you know, those voters from Transnistria did overwhelmingly support Dodon, sure, as is the case too with, again, with voters in Moldova's regions outside of, you know, outside of Chișinău. This is the trend. Again, typically they do, you know, typically there is stronger support for Dodon in, you know, in the regions. And again, that's also because many of these voters get their, kind of main source of information from television.
Yeah. Let's hope that you are right with your optimism. And
yes, I need to be optimistic for myself too.
Sure, we all have to be. But because that would be a very important milestone if it occurs that Moldovan institutions, at least in some extent, are strengthened. I would love to see that as well. But if we talk about challenges in front of Moldova, which is also a huge topic, I would like to focus on the near future, and I am especially interested in how the relation of Maia Sandu might look like with the government, because correct me if I'm wrong, but the function of or the position of the president in the Moldovan political system is not that strong. It's rather a representative function. So there is a crucial question how the president will cooperate with the government, or maybe we should expect a snap parliamentary elections next year.
So you bring up a very important point. And I think that, of course, today, you know, today those voters and kind of those people who support Maia Sandu are celebrating the fact that she won the presidency with 57% 57% of the vote. But of course, you know, it's like today we celebrate and tomorrow we look ahead and we look at the struggle before us. Cause of course, Moldova does have a parliamentary system. The executive branch is kind of not where the power and the control lies. And, you know, Maia Sandu does have an ambitious reform agenda, and rightly so. However, there are, you know, going to be major challenges in pushing through that reform agenda, given that the Socialist Party still controls the parliament. And of course, left over from kind of the short-lived coalition government between the Acum bloc from last year and the Socialists, there is, you know, at least from what I can tell in my own conversations with local civil society actors on the ground, there are hard feelings left over from last year. So, of course, you know, navigating that is going to be, you know, is going to be very challenging because, of course, the Socialists have their own interests in, you know, in whom they keep in various institutions, the extent to which reforms move forward or not. One quick example I'll share actually on reforms that have been sort of deadlocked that Maia Sandu, of course, would want to prioritize, and she did last time in her role of prime minister, is the reform of the framework for media, for independent media. Because there was some forward momentum on that a few years ago. There was actually, in fact, a parliamentary working group where civil society actors from 2017 to 2018 had important input into the reform of key laws that govern media, including the audiovisual code and the new code that was updated and passed. It's not perfect, but it was certainly better than the previous one. However, since 2019, forward momentum on reforming framework and operating environment for media has kind of been in stasis. Briefly, when Maia Sandu was prime minister, she tried to move those reform efforts over kind of into a special working group where civil society did still have input. But of course, once the government collapsed last November, or that government collapsed last November, you know, there's been no real way to move that agenda forward. And it's kind of been, you know, sidelined in the parliament, and the parliament, of course, you know, passes laws. So that's where that reform agenda would need to happen. And, you know, this is the case as well. You know, laws and legislation are kind of so important as part of kind of enacting Moldova's reform agenda. And I think that, of course, without the parliament, it's going to make things a lot more challenging for Maia Sandu. So then it will be a question of trying to negotiate and find common ground with the Socialists, which of course, you know, from my perspective, I think would be very difficult given that the Maia Sandu's party has already been kind of burned once after the short-lived coalition government last year. Or again, there would be this question of snap elections and seeing, you know, what the makeup of the parliament would be after that. But the parliament is a very necessary component of making progress when it comes to key areas such as, you know, anti-corruption efforts, improving the rule of law and access to justice so it works for all, key human rights commitments, and of course, as I was describing to you, media framework and operating environment for independent media.
And I guess the question is also what is the future of Dodon for himself? I mean, will he remain, do you think, the leader of the Socialist Party? And if so, that may cause a lot of problems for Maia Sandu in order to try to have some sort of working relationship with the Socialists.
That's a very good question. I think that, you know, if he's certainly not the leader of the Socialist Party, I think that he'll kind of remain a very strong voice within it. You know, I would not be surprised if he, of course, remained the leader of the Socialist Party. But I think that, yes, he would create, you know, I think that certainly he would, I would not be surprised if he created kind of obstacles or challenges, you know, for Maya Sandu to, you know, in her effort to enact a reform agenda. I think also too, another challenge that, you know, we haven't kind of addressed is the also dealing with the pro-Moldova party, which is kind of the remnants that, you know, came together from, you know, what used to be called the Democratic Party, which of course, as you know, was affiliated with Mr. Vlad Plahotniuk, who fled in 2019 following the constitutional crisis and then the coming together of the coalition government between Akum and the socialists. And, you know, as we've seen kind of from journalists reporting from Moldova, and again, also from, you know, speaking with my own contacts, it's been, you know, there's great kind of reluctance for, you know, and there's great kind of reluctance, and understandably so, kind of on Maya Sandu's part, to enter into negotiations either with the socialists or with pro-Moldova, because they're both parties are seen as tainted, and as kind of actors that have, you know, sort of a history of kind of fostering and enabling corruption in Moldova. But, you know, this is going to be kind of the big... This is going to be the big question is, you know, how do you work with who's there, you know, to ultimately enact a reform agenda that, you know, finally deals with tackling again, systemic, widespread endemic corruption, in key institutions. One kind of point I will make is, you know, I think this is something too, that's very common throughout the region is to kind of clear out, you know, everybody who, you know, all of those actors, you know, who are kind of like in the institution. So let's say, you know, clear out all of the, you know, judges who were, you know, affiliated with, you know, what used to be known as the Democratic Party or with the Socialist Party, and then, you know, find new people and put them in. But this isn't necessarily a viable solution either, because then you have a dearth of human capital to actually make these institutions function. So there's this question of, you know, how do you, you know, how will she reform these institutions and kind of work with who's there without, you know, kind of resorting to this tabula rasa situation where then you don't have enough people in place or enough expertise for that matter to make these institutions, you know, function after you've passed, you know, after you've passed a slate of reforms. This is, of course, you know, a future question, but it's nonetheless an important one.
Yeah,
sure. I have an impression that we've discussed a lot already, but maybe in the last part of our discussion, let's come back again to the civil society, which you mentioned several times already. But I would like to ask that, do you think that this Sandu's presidency can empower civil society? I mean that people can believe that the change is possible and they will be more... put more pressure on politicians to change the situation. The risk I see here is that if the expectations are too high and there are too many challenges to overcome, there is a problem if any change is or not enough change is delivered, then the disappointment on the society side might be very huge. So what do you think Sandu should do first in terms of, you know, introducing this new agenda you describe?
So this is, it's interesting because, of course, as you were formulating that question, I was having, you know, flashbacks to 2019 and the short-lived socialist Akum coalition government. And it was interesting because, of course, at that time, too, civil society's hopes were so high. It's no secret that, of course, there are many among civil society who have strongly kind of championed Maya Sandu for a very long time. You know, she also, too, has, you know, she is also someone who has, you know, sought input from civil society, has been kind of very transparent with them. And I think that that's something that, you know, civil society in Moldova greatly appreciates, is that she, you know, she is someone who has kind of truly been consultative with them, you know, versus, you know, other politicians and other political parties where there's kind of been the appearance of consultation, but it's kind of been, you know, very much window dressing or kind of to sort of tick the boxes, as they say. But whereas she has had, you know, she is someone who kind of truly, truly wants civil society at the table with her and providing input, you know, providing in kind of input into the reform agenda. So of course it's, it was interesting, again, kind of going back to last year, because hopes were very high, but then there was also this tremendous impatience, because I think that, you know, she hadn't been prime minister for even like a month or 6 weeks when, you know, I talked to kind of various folks on the ground, you know, or kind of getting a kind of a sense from others of, okay, well, what's happening with the reform agenda? When are these things going to move forward? You know, she's already been here for 6 weeks. And, you know, of course, the reaction is, well, you know, these types of processes take time. It's not all going to change overnight. But then kind of even through conversations with Sandu's cabinet at that time, she had a great sense of urgency, and she almost kind of sensed that, okay, this government isn't going to last long. I need to move, you know, as fast as I can. And of course, you know, ultimately that government only lasted for 5 months. So kind of all of this to say, now that Maya Sandu is president-elect, I think that, you know, it will be important for civil society to kind of not fall back into that same, you know, kind of same level of impatience. I think that it is absolutely their role, you know, no, regardless of who holds the presidency or and who holds the parliament, it is absolutely the role of civil society to hold the government accountable and responsible for, you know, not just delivering on their promises, but also ensuring that people, you know, people have input into and have a voice, you know, into, you know, into the decision-making process. But I think that, you know, it will be important for civil society actors to hold her accountable for her, to her promises, but then also to not become, to the extent that it's possible, not become kind of overly impatient. Because again, that was kind of a major challenge from last time. And one more kind of thing to note is that typically when kind of a key sort of reformer, you know, such as Maya Sandu, becomes an elected official, it's not uncommon to see kind of civil society actors then go into government. We actually saw this in Ukraine in 2014 after the Revolution of Dignity. There were several kind of well-known investigative journalists and activists who ended up going into the parliament. So, you know, one important thing to keep in mind is, while, you know, it won't be surprising to see some civil society activists in Moldova, I would say particularly some of Maya Sandu's kind of greatest supporters and champions, go into the government, it will be important for, you know, civil society to at least kind of like maintain its voice. And, you know, I would hope that not everyone would go into government, because then there won't, of course, be anyone left to play that important role.
Yeah.
So, you know, so all of this to say, you know, we will probably see some civil society folks join her cabinet. But at the same time, it's, I think, very important that not everyone kind of jump in at once, and that, you know, civil society's voice in Moldova kind of remains strong and clear, and, you know, kind of that they ring that bell of kind of responsibility, accountability, and transparency on the part of the government.
Well, definitely a lot of challenges ahead for Maya Sandu as she's preparing to take on the presidency. We'll see how that goes, but I think, Gina, I have a sense that you're somewhat optimistic with the direction for Moldova at the moment, so I think that's good to hear. And thanks again for joining us for the discussion. There's a lot happening. Moldova sometimes seems like this little country in Eastern Europe, but really what happens in Moldova sometimes is a reflection of what's happening in the wider region and in really the wider Europe and the rest of the world as well. So I think I really do appreciate your input and your knowledge and your perspective on this, and I hope that we can have you again sometime soon on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. And yes, I think Moldova really is a bright spot right now in the region. And these were historic elections, and I'm looking forward to to seeing what will unfold under Maia Sandu's leadership, and again as Moldova's first woman president.
Great. Thanks. We'll be watching.
Thank you. Take care.
And that was our interview with Gina Lentine from Freedom House. She's an expert, senior program officer and expert on Eastern Europe and Turkey. Maciek, I think that was a very interesting discussion on Moldova, on the situation, what might happen next. Of course, there are still a lot of many unknowns, but really one of the biggest upsets of 2020, and the change of direction politically, geopolitically, maybe even socially and economically. For Moldova is the fact that Maia Sandu is president. As we mentioned, of course, in the discussion, she won't have a lot of power. She is, the president is more of a figurehead in some sense in Moldova, like many other parliamentary democracies. But I think the symbolic fact that she was elected, that she beat Igor Dodon, who is, much more of a pro-Russian candidate, more skeptical towards European integration. I think this is definitely an important signal.
Absolutely. The thing we did not discuss during the interview is the potential response from the EU towards Moldova. I think that the political signal that the EU is still there.
True.
Would be now an important act, political act toward Moldova. I am not sure if the European Union is now ready for such an act. Of course, we need to also wait for the first months of the presidency of Maia Sandu. But that would be at least the kind of development I would like to see.
I agree. I think the European Union has kind of somewhat disengaged from Moldova over the past couple of years. I think especially since her government fell in 2019, we saw a lot of disengagement on the EU side. So I think now you're right. I think the ball is a little bit in the EU's court to try to re-engage and to help Maia Sandu strengthen her position. We will see how it goes. Of course, everybody is also dealing with pandemic. And the question also is the Eastern Partnership, if there's an opportunity for it to be a platform to help Moldova, also integrate more with EU.
It was great to have Gina Lentine again on Talk Eastern Europe. I really value her expertise. So I hope it was not the last time. And she promised us that she will visit us again. So
yeah.
That's always good news. And now I would like to smoothly move to the last part of our episode. And this is very traditional. I always call it traditional part of each episode, because this is exactly when we can say thank you to all our patrons, first of all, and all our supporters, and also thanks to, and also I would like, this time I would like also say hello to all our new members of our Facebook group. The group is constantly growing, and we are aware that we should do a little bit more to activate this group. But believe me or not, it was very, very busy time for us to produce something new and special, and I think Adam, you will tell now something about our new product.
Yes, I think this is probably the most important announcement after the patrons, but I will do this one first, and that is exactly the reason why we've been a little less productive on Talk Eastern Europe, is because we've been producing a special documentary series called The Story of Belarus, the Nation, Its History, and a New Hope. And we produced the first 5 episodes, have been just released on November 23rd. And the next 5 episodes, the final 5 episodes, it's a full 10-part series, will be released on November 30th. I highly recommend that you all take a look and listen to it. What we really aim to do is to try to help our listeners, global listeners, really understand what is happening in Belarus. And we go from history, we look at the historical discussions, identity, language, culture, society, and we go through the fall of Soviet Union, how Lukashenko came to power, how he kept his power. We talk about the social changes that have been taking place in the country since the last several years, and of course go through the most recent changes, and that was the presidential election and the protests and the violence that took place after and that continue to take place till today. So really, I can't recommend it enough. We are very happy and proud that we were able to have this project. But check out The Story of Belarus. It should be available almost anywhere that you listen to podcasts. And we will, of course, have links to it in this podcast episode as well.
Yeah, one more thing. Since we already got some feedback about the series after the release, it is somehow... I don't know why, but sometimes it's not that easy to find maybe this series on some platforms. I assume that different platforms work differently, but nevertheless, as Adam said, we want to have it available on all main platforms that are available right now for listening to the podcast. But if you have any problem with finding it, it is always... available on our Facebook group. That's first yep. source of knowledge about our podcast, and then on also on the www.spreaker.com. So I think this
You can go to neweasterneurope.eu/Belarus and all the episodes will be there as well. So we hope you enjoy the special series, and we will start getting back into more Talk Eastern Europe episodes shortly as well. And that also brings me, of course, Maciek, to our final announcement, which is the most important, in my opinion, and that is the shout-out to our patrons. I just want to recommend and remind all of our listeners who are listening to this episode that if you enjoy Talk Eastern Europe, we are definitely funded, and the most of our resources come from our listeners, the support we receive from our listeners. You can become a patron if you go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/talkeastern Europe. And I want to thank the 25 members that we currently have. We really do appreciate your support. Thank you to Plummen, Sean, Amy, Naomi, Sylvia, JP, Elise, Sean, David, Anastasia, William, Pavel, Urs, Ian, Sophia, Wilhelm, David, Elizabeth, Erica, Janos, Jason, Mark, Stephanie, Pierre, and Scape Ghost. Thank you all for your support, and we really do appreciate it. And another benefit that we have, which we'll be preparing, I think, our next one very soon in December, is a special Zoom discussions with the co-hosts. So Maciek and I and our patrons, we get together and discuss issues, and we have some special ideas as well for the patrons' engagement in the Zoom discussion. So if you want to go beyond just listening to the podcast and become an active member of Talk Eastern Europe community, please do feel free to become a patron.
Yeah, thank you everyone for listening this episode. I hope you enjoy it. If you also listen to The Story of Belarus, which I really invite you to do so, please share us your feedback, because this is something new for us, and we are also interested to know if we should from time to time produce this kind of content as well.
Okay, Maciek, I think that's all we have for today. Thank you everyone out there for all of your support, for listening, for reading, for your feedback. And we look forward to engaging with you again. So take care for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.